time is holy. Over and again, what we notice as we study both Scripture and as we observe things around us, both in our present day and historically, if we're careful to take notice, what we will begin to observe is a perceived meaningful coincidences. Perceived meaningful coincidences. Some talk about synchronicity of events and how certain things seem to occur at specific times for specific reasons. It's not always observable at the time that it happens, but quite often we can look back and make these connections. I'm talking today a little bit about the rhythm, the cycle of the seasons. By the way, I'm going to be talking a little bit about our Torah portion as well, but I have to bring all this together. So whenever we talk about dates and times and seasons, what we begin to notice is that quite often this rhythm or this cycle of time tends to prove to be quite significant. In fact, when we talk about Hanukkah, we talk about this particular time in the biblical ninth month. It's all based on this idea that something bad happened on a particular day. And then at the same time, at the same season, something good happened, very same time. Now, if a person joining us today is following the annual cycle of readings, you will be in the reading called Miketz. Miketz. This also is in the book of Genesis, as we are in the book of Genesis. According to the annual cycle of readings, at least for today and the next couple of weeks, those following the annual cycle of readings are in the book of Genesis. They're in the Joseph cycle, just as we are. In this particular Sabbath, according to the annual cycle of readings, there is an additional Torah reading that comes from the book of Numbers, the book of Bamidbar, and it comes from chapter 7, verses 30 through 35. Why is that? Why do we have a special reading today? We have a special reading because this is called Shabbat Hanukkah. This is the Sabbath of Hanukkah. The prophet reading according to the annual cycle is Zechariah chapter 2, beginning in verse 14, through chapter 4, verse 7. Among other things, there is an interesting reading there that one might associate with the lighting or the kindling of lights. So I want to begin by touching on the season of Hanukkah. Now, first off, I want to make this statement very clearly. Hanukkah is not a biblical festival. It is not a biblical festival. So where you will find the story of Hanukkah is in the apocryphal book known as the Maccabees. All right, now most of you know this, but I'm just making it a very solid point going into today's class. You will find the story in probably its earliest form in the book of Maccabees. And in that particular story, as it unfolds, there's no mention whatsoever of a magic candlestick or a miraculous supply of oil which burns. You know the story that's told later, that when they went to rededicate the temple and the altar, that they went in among the ruins and found there a sealed vial of oil, which was only sufficient to burn for one day. But the priest used it, and miraculously it lasted a full 8 days until more supply could be produced and they could carry on as normal. The book of Maccabees knows nothing of this magic jug of oil. It doesn't occur whatsoever. The story of Hanukkah that covers some of the miraculous deeds that I mentioned and so forth, you'll find references in the Mishnah and in the Talmud. You will find the story of Hanukkah in Josephus. You'll find mention of Hanukkah in the Gospel of John in the Christian New Testament. Chapter 10, it mentions the Feast of Dedication, and it was winter. But you won't find anything of this story as it is popularly celebrated, at least on the miraculous side, in the book of Maccabees. The story, as it seems to have originally been told, is the story of a clash of cultures. Greco-Syrian culture clashing and meeting head-on with the Hebraic faith. In some ways, the story talks about a battle between false and true religion. It's the story about when, during a time when worshiping according to the ancient Hebrew faith could bring the penalty of death. Pretty powerful story. When observing the commandments might lead one to be killed. It talks about a world ruler that is known in chapter 1 of 1 Maccabees as a sinful root. His name is Antiochus Epiphanes. Epiphanes is often understood to be like the God manifest. So this sinful root, this arrogant one, Antiochus, is the world ruler. He puts forth a call to all people, basically that all people would be one and that they would worship according to a solitary religion, and that furthermore that they would forsake all of their particular customs. And many of you have read this story over the last few days since we are more than halfway through Hanukkah. But the thing that I want to tell you is that many accepted this religion. In fact, the Torah was rejected according to this religion. Copies of the Torah were both torn and burned. They found a written copy, it would be burned. Israel is described as going into hiding. Now, I might point out that some, even in Israel, accepted this religion, but there were some who were trying to be faithful to the covenant who had to go into hiding. And then finally, a faithful remnant resolved to fight. Those who were zealous for the Torah. It tells us in 1 Maccabees that a particular group headed by a now famous family known as the Maccabees sort of led this revolt, and they went into the wilderness. All those who were seeking to live their life according to truth and justice and righteousness, and fight they did. And ultimately, they won. According to the story, a classic manifestation of God moving on behalf of his people takes place. As I pointed out, it says very clearly that at the same time, the story of Maccabees reveals how the altar and so forth was profaned, but it tells us in 1 Maccabees that at the same time, on the same day, the selfsame day that the profanation took place, that the redemption came and the cleansing and the dedication. So most of you know this, but Hanukkah, the root word Hanach, means to dedicate. So the idea is that on this particular day, 3 years later to the day of the altar being profaned, that it was rededicated. And so the date is on the 25th day of the ninth month, the month known as Kislev. Now, because of this, according to 1 Maccabees chapter 4, every year beginning on this day, for 8 days, a time of gladness and joy would be observed. Now, later stories, as I mentioned, would be added, stories such as the oil, the miracle of the oil, and so forth. But I wanted to bring this up. Some of you saw this article that James Tabor posted, because I want to draw attention to this, because I'm going to associate This season, the prophets of Israel and the ancient Torah reading according to the triennial cycle that we happen to be on today, I'm going to tie all of that together in my class. And I want to begin by telling you a little bit about how this particular season had significance long before the Maccabees ever came into existence. This season had significance before the victory of the Maccabees. In fact, more than 350 years before the Maccabees, this particular season, according to a prophetic reading that I'm going to cover with you today, declared this season to be quite significant. In fact, the overthrow of enemy kingdoms, kings, and nations will forever be associated with this season and with the month of Kislev. I want you to turn with me this morning to the prophet Haggai, and we are going to read. The way that I'll begin this class, I want to draw your attention to a specific date that is mentioned in the prophet Haggai. If you go to the prophet Haggai to chapter 2, and I just want to read verse 10, the first part. It says, on the 24th day of the ninth month. The 24th day of the ninth month. Now, just to let you know, if you don't know, the ninth biblical month is the month of Kislev. This particular passage continues, in the second year of Daryavesh, the word of Jehovah came by Haggai the prophet, saying, thus says Jehovah of hosts. Now, this particular story, I'm not going to go into the content of the prophetic word which comes to Haggai from Jehovah on the 24th day of the ninth month, but I just simply want to draw your attention to the specific date mentioned here. Now, go to verse 18 of chapter 2 in Haggai. Now, this, by the way, is Jehovah speaking. Actually, I want to begin in verse 17. I smote you with blasting and with mildew, with hail in all the labors of your hands, yet you turn not to me, says Jehovah. But now consider, from this day onwards, from the 24th day of the ninth month, from the day that the foundation of Jehovah's temple was laid, consider it. Is the seed yet in the barn? And do the vine and the fig tree and the pomegranate and the olive tree still not bring forth? From this day I will bless you. Notice this day, very specific. According to what we're seeing in chapter 2 of the prophet Haggai, we're talking about the 24th day of the ninth month. Now, notice in verse 20. Now, this is where the white space occurs. It says this in chapter 2 of Haggai, verse 20. And again, the word of Jehovah came to Haggai on the 24th day of the month, saying, speak to Zerubbabel, governor of Yehuda, saying, I will shake the heavens and the earth. I will overthrow the throne of kingdoms. And I will destroy the strength of the kingdoms of the nations. And I will overthrow the chariots and those that ride in them. The horses and their riders shall come down, every one by the sword of his brother. On that day, says Jehovah of hosts. And it continues. Now, something I wanted to point out. This particular season where the word of Jehovah comes to Haggai happens to be the month of Kislev, the 24th day. He leads up to a prophetic word that says, from this day forward, I will bless you. Specifically, he says to a leader of Judah, he says that he will overthrow kingdoms, that he will destroy the strength of kingdoms, that he will overthrow. Now listen to the language, because this sounds to me is as something prophetic, but it's also referring back to another great deliverance. Notice he talks about overthrowing chariots and those that ride, and he mentions specifically horse and rider. Now, if you think about the book of Exodus, the book of Shemot, when we see the deliverance of Israel, one of the things that is very well known is that the Song of the Sea, the deliverance of the Song of the Sea from Exodus chapter 15, often called the Song of Moses, but it's really not, the Song of the Sea, I will sing unto the Lord, for he is triumphed gloriously, the horse and the rider thrown into the sea. You know this song. This idea is that God will act on behalf of his people, and that from this particular day, he will bless his people. Now, those of you who read Dr. Tabor's article, he points out something quite remarkable. When I began today, I made it a point to stress that what we have in studying of dates and times and seasons is often that these times prove to be significant for many, many cycles of generations. So in Tabor's article, he points out that something quite remarkable takes place. In 1917, when General Allenby, the British commander, liberated Jerusalem from the Turkish Muslim rule, the date on the Hebrew calendar was the 24th day of the ninth month. After many, many years of being ruled by the Ottomans, the British actually delivered and redeemed Jerusalem at this season, now 100 years ago. In fact, when I was in Israel in November, Jono Vandoor and I participated with a group in the 100th anniversary celebrating the centennial of the Australian Light Horse Brigade when they fought down at Beersheba. And then we went up to Jerusalem, and there was some talk about the General Allenby and so forth. But it's at this time. So, in fact, this particular year on Kislev 24, the 24th day of the ninth month, which just passed last week, was the 100th anniversary of General Allenby redeeming Jerusalem, basically conquering Jerusalem and restoring it. Now, it's interesting. Did you remember that on December 6th, which was Kislev 18, a certain U.S. president made a declaration about Jerusalem? Interestingly enough, it was in this same season, 100 years later. So you can do with that as you please. But I think it's quite significant that once again we see this pattern begin to emerge, that certain key events take place at a certain time and certain places. So I thought that even though all of these things were quite significant and interesting, that I would need to put all of these associations aside and to prepare a class based upon a random reading from the book of Genesis, according to an ancient 3.5-year cycle that no one really follows anymore. And I thought, you know, all of those things are interesting, and it's Hanukkah, but it really has nothing at all to do with Genesis chapter 46. So I'll look at that later. And I would gladly have done that until something happened. I was reading in a book, or referencing, I should say, a book called The Bible as Read and Preached in the Old Synagogue. Now, this is a two-volume set. The author, at least for the first volume and part of the second, he died. One of his students took over, and then he died. And I'm scared to take over the project, to be quite honest with you. But what this does is, Rabbi Mann began to look at these ancient cycles, these ancient Sedarim from the Hebrew Bible, and looking into rabbinic literature and Jewish literature and such, because what he wanted to do was find out how these were preached in the ancient synagogue. So like for 1 year now, I've been working through these Torah cycle of readings, and sometimes I find something of interest according to what is written here. So I wanted to tell you what I found last night. I opened up in this particular reading, which begins with Genesis chapter 46, verse 28. It's listed as Seder number 42, according to all the ancient sources. And it as I read through this particular chapter, I got to this verse or this section, and here's what it says. In the first year of the cycle of, in the first year of the cycle, the Pentateuch portion for Sabbath Hanukkah was Genesis 46, verse 28. Now, that might not seem significant to many of you, but let me explain to you why I found it of interest. Whenever I was reading through this, I often wonder how closely we are to tracking the triennial reading portions with the way it would have been tracked in the ancient synagogue. And sometimes we get indications from rabbinic literature or from various quotations from antiquity that sort of put us on track. What this tells me is that based on the beginning point in the ancient synagogue following the triennial cycle of reading, which was only done in the land of Israel, the annual cycle of reading was developed in Babylon, by the way. You can look this up. It's in the Talmud and it's in other sources. But the ancient triennial cycle was followed in the land of Israel. And when they got to the Sabbath of Hanukkah, they would have been at Genesis chapter 46 and verse 28 and following. With that, I will now read from the Transparent English Bible, Genesis chapter 46, beginning in verse 28. You can find this on our Facebook group page. I upload these files every week, and then at the end of the class today, when I post the audio and video of the teaching, I'll also post this particular portion from Tabor's translation on our website, unitedisrael.org. So, here we go, Genesis 46, verse 28. And he sent Judah before his face toward Joseph to teach before his face toward Goshen. And they came toward the land of Goshen. Joseph bound his chariot and went up toward Goshen to meet Israel, his father, toward Goshen, and he was seen to him and fell upon his neck and wept upon his neck still. And Israel said toward Joseph, "Let me die this time after seeing your face, for you are still alive." And Joseph said toward his brothers and toward his house, the house of his father, "I am going up, will tell to Pharaoh and say toward him, 'My brothers and the house of my father who were in the land of Canaan have come toward me, and the men are ones pasturing of a flock, for they have been men of acquired livestock in their flock and their herds, and all that is to them they have caused to come. And it will be when Pharaoh calls to you and says, "What are your doings?" you will say, "Your servants have been men of acquired livestock from our youth until now." both we and our fathers, in order that you may sit in the land of Goshen. For a detestable thing to the Egyptians is one pasturing a flock. Now, if you're new, by the way, this is a very literal translation called the Transparent English Bible, because it is, in a way, bringing you the very literal English that if you're looking at the English that I'm reading here, you're actually peering into the Hebrew. We're in chapter 47, verse 1. Joseph went and told to Pharaoh and said, "My father and my brothers and their flock and their herd and all that is to them have come from the land of Canaan. And look, they are in the land of Goshen." From the end of his brothers, he took five men and caused them to be set in the face of Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said toward his brothers, "What are your doings?" And they said toward Pharaoh, "Once pasturing a flock are your servants, both us and our fathers." And they said toward Pharaoh, "To sojourn in the land we've come, for there is no pasture for the flocks that are to your servants, for the hunger is weighty in the land of Canaan. And now let your servants please sit in the land of Goshen." And Pharaoh spoke toward Joseph, saying, "Your father and your brothers have come toward you. The land of Egypt is before your face. Cause your father and your brothers to sit in the best of the land. Let them sit in the land of Goshen. And if you know, and there are in them men of force, and place them chief of the acquired livestock upon what is to me." And Joseph caused Jacob, his father, to come, and he caused him to stand before the face of Pharaoh. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said toward Jacob, "How many are the days of the years of your life?" And Jacob said toward Pharaoh, the days of the years of my sojournings are 30 and 100 years. Few and bad have been the days of the years of my life, and they have not reached the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their sojournings." And Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from before the face of Pharaoh, and Joseph caused to sit his father and his brothers and gave to them a holding in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Rameses, as Pharaoh charged. And Joseph supported his father and his brothers and all the house of his father with bread to the mouth of the toddler. And there was no bread in all the land, for weighty was the hunger exceedingly, and the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan became weak from the face of the hunger. Joseph collected all the silver that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for the grain that they were buying, and Joseph caused the silver to come toward the house of Pharaoh. And the silver was completed from the land of Egypt and from the land of Canaan, and all the Egyptians came toward Joseph, saying, "Give to us bread. Why should we die before you, for silver ceases?" Joseph said, "Give your acquired livestock, and I will give to you for your acquired livestock if the silver is at an end." And they caused their livestock to come toward Joseph. And Joseph gave to them bread for their horses and for the acquired livestock of the flock and for the acquired livestock of the herd and for the donkeys. And he led them on with bread for all their acquired livestock in that year. And that year was completed, and they came toward him in the second year and said to him, "We will not hide from my master, for if the silver is completed and the acquired livestock of the animals that are toward my master, not there is left before the face of my master except our bodies and our soil. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our soil? Acquire us and our soil for bread, and we and our soil will be servants to Pharaoh, and give seed, and we'll live and not die, and that the land be not desolate." Joseph acquired all the soil of Egypt for Pharaoh, for they sold the Egyptians a man his field, for the hunger was strong on them, and the land was to Pharaoh. A few more verses. The people, he caused them to pass over to the cities from the end of the border of Egypt and unto its end, until the soil of the priest he did not acquire, for a prescribed portion was to the priest from with Pharaoh, and they ate their prescribed portion that Pharaoh gave to them. Therefore, they did not sell their soil. Joseph said toward the people, "Look, I have acquired you today, and your soil for Pharaoh. Look, seed for you, and you will sow the soil. And it will be in the harvest times, and you will give a fifth to Pharaoh, and four hands will be to yourself for seed of the field and for your eatable things and for those who are in your houses and for eatable things for your toddlers." And they said, you've caused us to live and find favor in the eyes of my master, and we will be servants to Pharaoh. Joseph placed it for a prescription until this day. Upon the soil of Egypt to Pharaoh is a fifth. Only the soil of the priest alone was not to Pharaoh. And Israel sat in the land of Egypt, in the land of Goshen, and they were taken hold in it, and bare fruit and were abundant exceedingly. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 7 and 10 years. The days of Jacob, the years of his life, were 7 years and 40 and 100 years. The days of Israel to die came near, and he called to his son to Joseph and said to him, if please, I have found favor in your eyes, place, please, your hand under my thigh, and do with me loyal kindness and trustfulness, bearing me not, please, in Egypt. And I have lain down with my fathers, and you will lift me from Egypt and bury me in their burial place. And he said, I will do as your spoken thing. And he said, swear to me. And he swore to him, and Israel bowed himself upon the head of the bed. This concludes the reading. And now I will talk about what we've read. The translation, for those who are asking, is called the Transparent English Bible. It's available partly on the web. You can see and read about the project. Someone could probably help me and post that link. But anyway, according to this particular story, there is a great reunion. Joseph finally, after all of the events leading up to this point, is reunited with the whole family, but they're in Egypt. Now, this is all part of a divine plan. I'm going to kind of work things a different angle today because I want to jump into the prophets. According to these ancient cycle of readings, the intention was always to associate a prophetic text with a reading from the Torah. According to our ancient sources, there were a couple of prophecies that were associated with what I just read. One of those is quite interesting, and I want you to go with me to the book of Zechariah. Go with me to chapter 10 of Zechariah. According to the ancient triennial cycle of readings, the sages associated this text with our Torah reading. So I'm going to begin in chapter 10, verse 3 at the white space. Prophet Zechariah. My anger burns against the shepherds. Now, I want to pause just for a moment. Throughout the prophecies, you know, I'm getting ready to go into a new study that I'm very excited about. I've been studying for about 30 years on this, and one of the themes that you'll see quite often is that shepherds are often associated with the teachers and those who care for the flock, if you will. Ezekiel 34 is one very big example. But Zechariah, especially as we move from chapter 10 into chapter 11, we see sort of a condemnation of the shepherds. So think about that. Now, there is a connection here with our reading. In the reading that we read today, you remember the brothers were told by Joseph, when you go to Pharaoh, don't tell him you're shepherds. You know, don't tell him you take care of livestock because shepherds are an abomination. And here's the way that happened. Hey, boys, I'm Pharaoh. What's your occupation? We're shepherds. Like, bam, right out of the gate. They were just told, don't tell him that. Nonetheless, it works out for them, and they still get the choice land. So here we go. My anger, verse 3 of chapter 10, my anger burns against the shepherds, and I will punish the goats. For Jehovah of hosts has remembered his flock, the house of Judah, and makes them like the magnificent steed in the battle. Out of him, we're talking about Judah, shall come forth the cornerstone. Out of him the stake. Out of him the battle bow. Out of him every ruler together. Now, your mind, if you know Scripture, ought to be making a lot of associations. We're talking about some key themes. We have the cornerstone. We have the battle bow, every ruler. Remember Genesis chapter 49. Now, verse 5. And they shall be like mighty men who tread down their enemies in the mire of the streets in the battle, and they shall fight because Jehovah is with them. And the riders on horses shall be confounded. And I will strengthen the house of Judah, and I will save the house of Joseph. Notice Judah and Joseph mentioned specifically in this particular story, this prophecy. And I will bring them back again, for I have had mercy on them, and they will be as though I had not cast them off. For I am Jehovah their God, and will hear them. They of Ephraim shall be like a mighty man, and their hearts shall rejoice as through wine. Their children shall see it and be glad. Their hearts shall rejoice in Jehovah. I will whistle to them and gather them. For I have redeemed them, and they shall increase as they have before increased. Notice, and I will sow them among the peoples, and they will remember me in far countries. And they shall live with their children and shall return. And I will bring them back out of the land of Mitzrayim, Egypt, and gather them out of Assyria, and I will bring them into the land of Gilead and Lebanon, so that there will be no room for them, and he shall pass through the sea with affliction, shall smite the waves in the sea. What does this sound like? Sound like the Exodus, right? And all the deeps of the river shall dry up, and the pride of Assyria will be brought down, and the scepter of Egypt shall depart away. I will strengthen them in Jehovah, and they shall walk up and down in his name, says Jehovah. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a redemptive text. It has not happened yet. This prophecy describes the people of God. Now listen to me. I want you to understand that this second exodus, if you will, to recover God's people is going to be one that will shock the world. I made this point. I want you to understand. You can't pick out God's people based on race, creed, color. It says in the book of Amos that God scattered his people through all nations as corn is sifted through a sieve, yet not the least grain will fall to the ground. My eyes are on all their ways. What God is telling us is that you're not going to find some particular group in some particular place that just has escaped our notice, and that's where they've been hiding all these years, right? So what we're looking for is we're looking for this great redemption to take place, and these prophetic texts are very clear. They mention over and over the way that it's going to go down, and when they do, it brings back echoes, if you will, of the ancient rescue that took place in Egypt. Notice whenever the prophets talk about those that were in Egypt and those that were in Assyria, what this is doing, Isaiah chapter 11, many, many other texts do this as well, it talks about the remnant of the exile, wherever they ended up, they began either in Egypt or Assyria, in Babylon. All of these ideas are meant to suggest that that the ultimate redemption is going to bring back all of those who were scattered literally all over the place, the face of the earth. Now listen, this particular text in Zechariah chapter 10 is associated with the great redemption, and here's what I want you to understand. This latter day return, as I work through this text, in verse 6, it says, I will bring them back. In verse 8, I will gather them. Listen to this language. Verse 9, they shall return. Verse 10, I will bring them back, gather them, bring them. And finally, this is interesting to me. Look at verse 12. They shall walk up and down in his name, saith Jehovah. They shall walk up and down in his name. Listen, when you study the prophets, you're looking for connections from the words, in connection with the words, and on the basis of the words. This particular phrase, walking in the name, brings to mind another passage. If we go to the book of Micah, go with me to Micah chapter 4. Micah chapter 4, beginning in verse 1, is where the white space is. Those of you who might be new, when I mention the white space, according to the Hebrew text, there are actually divisions that are clearly indicated in the text, and they don't always coincide with the English verse numbers. So it begins in chapter 4, verse 1. This, by the way, is also almost an exact copy of a prophecy that is given in Isaiah chapter 2, with a very slight difference. We might get into that later, but I will not touch it now. Micah chapter 4, but in the last days it shall come to pass that the mountain of the house of Jehovah shall be established on top of the mountains, and it shall be exalted above the hills, and peoples shall stream towards it. Many nations shall come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of Jehovah, to the house of the God of Jacob. And he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For Torah shall go forth from Zion, and the word of Jehovah from Jerusalem. And he shall judge many people, and decide concerning strong nations afar off. And they will beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, nor shall they learn war any more. But they shall sit, every man, under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid, for the mouth of Jehovah of hosts has spoken it. For let all the people, get this, walk every one in the name of his God. But we will walk in the name of Jehovah our God forever and ever. This particular text talks about the very end, if you will, when the Torah will go forth from Zion and Jerusalem, the word of Jehovah, to the ends of the earth, and all nations will learn. This comes after a time when judgment against the nations is pronounced. It comes after that time, because even after that time, when war is no more, when swords are beaten into and spears are beaten into instruments or implements of farming, tools for farming are made of weapons. What a glorious day that will be. But there's a connection here, and it talks about here walking in the name of Jehovah, which is also mentioned in Zechariah chapter 10. This particular reading from Zechariah 10 is pointing us towards the ultimate family reunion, the much anticipated great family reunion. Now remember, this was facilitated by necessity. If the people of Israel anciently in our narrative, and oh, by the way, in the modern day, if that reunion were left to happen on its own, it would not happen. Primarily, and I mentioned this in last week's class, I'm going to be getting more into these prophecies, but one of the main reasons that it won't happen is predicted and stated very clearly in Isaiah chapter 11, verse 13. That being, Ephraim and Judah cannot come together at the present because Ephraim is jealous of Judah and wants to be Judah. Every day, every week, it seems I meet someone from among the nations who wakes up to a realization. They feel as though they're Israel, Joseph, Ephraim, and then they immediately go to be Judah. Isaiah chapter 11, verse 13 says that Ephraim will not be jealous of Judah. And it also says that Judah will not harass Ephraim. Presently, Ephraim is so worried about becoming Judah and so jealous of Judah, and Judah is so much harassing Ephraim in some situations, that that redemption is not taking place at the time that it might should. So here's my point. The bottom line is that if left alone, it wouldn't happen. But according to the story, the narrative that we're working through, something interesting. God drives the reunion. He drives the reunion through famine. Remember the story, the narrative, as the narrative goes, when we work through the book of Genesis, there's a great famine, and Jacob sees that there is food in Egypt. And he sends the boys down there, and this ultimately leads to the redemption. Now, I have taught over the past several weeks, and I believe this, that the thing that's going to drive the latter-day reunion is famine. Amos chapter 9, Amos chapter 8, verse 11 says that, days are coming, saith Jehovah, there will be a famine in the land, not a famine of bread and water, but of hearing the word of Jehovah. The famine is a lack of the word. And you'll recall in Deuteronomy chapter 8, verses 2 and following, it says that man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds forth from the mouth of Jehovah. So the true sustenance that is going to feed the sheep, if you will, feed the people, is going to be the actual word of Jehovah. We even see this also in another prophecy in Ezekiel chapter 37. In Ezekiel 37, God brings Ezekiel to a valley. He looks out over a valley and he shows him a valley of dry bones. And he says, can they live? Ezekiel says, you know. And he says, prophesy to the bones, say, hear the word of Jehovah. Once again, the famine, what leads to the death is a lack of the word of Jehovah. What brings life is to hear the word. And ultimately, if you follow that in Ezekiel 37, you will see that you have two things take place. You have the word going forth, and then you have the spirit. One second. When something happens and, you know, you get something pop in your head, you got to write it down. All right. So here we have famine forced the reunion. Joseph was believed to be dead. He was described over and over in the narrative as the one who was not. Not only in the historical narrative, but in the prophecies, you'll recall Jeremiah 31, verse 15 and following, it says it very clearly that Rachel is weeping for her sons because they are not. But when Judah, according to this story, Judah, driven by a love and care for the father, drew near to Joseph. Joseph ultimately revealed himself to his brothers. Now, the brothers go back. I'm bringing us up to this point in today's story. The brothers inform the aged patriarch that Joseph is yet alive. Od Yosef Chai. The one who was thought to be dead is alive. Now, once Jacob, Israel, recognizes and accepts that his son Joseph is really alive, he decides to go see him before he dies. Go with me, please, to the book of Genesis, chapter 46. We're going to go back to pick this up. Genesis chapter 46. And you'll recall in chapter 45, verse 28 of Genesis, "It is enough. Joseph, my son, is still alive. I will go and see him before I die." Chapter 46, verse 1, "And Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father, Isaac. And God spoke to Israel in a vision of the night and said, 'Yaakov, Yaakov.' And he said, 'Hineni, here am I.' And he said, 'I am God, the God of your father.'" In fact, in Hebrew, he says, "Anoki ha'el Elohe avicha." I am God. I am the God of your father. "Fear not to go down to Mitzrayim," or Egypt, "for I will there make of thee a great nation. I will go down with you into Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again. And Joseph shall put his hand on your eyes." This is a very interesting dream. Visions of the night. Jacob, Israel, has just learned that his son Joseph is alive. Now, he's thought he was dead. He finds out he's alive. He gets excited and he says, "Before I die, I'm going to rush down there and I'm going to go see him." So he has this dream. God appears to him. And I want you to notice a couple of things about this dream. In fact, I'm gonna pick this up in just a minute. Go, hold your hand here and go to Genesis 28. I want to cover one other dream that Jacob had that points to the same. Genesis 28, verse 12. You remember the story. Jacob had left Beersheba and he's going towards Haran when he has this particular dream. And it says this, and he dreamed, verse 12, 28, 12. "Dreamed, and behold, a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven, and behold, angels of God ascending and descending on it. Behold, Jehovah stood above it and said, 'I am Jehovah, God of Abraham, your father, the God of Yitzhak. The land on which you lie, to you will I give it, and to your seed, and your seed shall be as the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west, and to the east, and to the north, and to the south, and in thee and in thy seed all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Behold, I am with you, and I will keep you in all places to which you go, and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done that which I have spoken of.' And Jacob awoke out of his sleep." Now, these are both dreams, but I want you to understand something very important. The entire plan of God is conveyed to Israel through a dream. He's told in Genesis 28 and in Genesis chapter 46, in a vision of the night, Jacob is given the vision, the plan. Now, a lot of times we tend to think that God showed up. He stood right in front of Jacob and he said, "Jacob, I'm God. I'm here to tell you the plan." He communicates to him in a dream and in a vision, the ultimate plan. So what I want you to do is, in the first dream, in Genesis chapter 28, Jehovah, Hashem, plans and tells him that he's going to give him a land and seed. Now listen to me. In Genesis 28, the land has not become his and he has no children yet. He's given a glimpse of the plan. Not only does he not have children at this point, but he's given details about the plan of God that some would miss. Now, I covered this before, but this ties into today's class as well, so you get to hear it again. In Genesis 28, he tells Jacob that his seed will be basically dispersed to the west, to the east, to the north, and to the south. This describes his descendants being scattered throughout all nations as corn is sifted through a sieve. Amos chapter 9, verse 9. He talks about this prophecy that there will be universal blessing, right? And in you will all the nations of the earth be blessed, or as some translate the Niphal there, bless themselves or be blessed therein, or however it's translated variously. The idea is that Israel's seed will become a conduit of blessing that is global in its impact. This particular promise is conveyed four times in the patriarchal narratives. It's conveyed in Genesis 12. It's conveyed in Genesis chapter 22. It's conveyed in chapter 28. And it's conveyed over and over. It's hinted at in other texts as well. I'll bless you. You'll be a blessing. And all nations will bless themselves. Now, here's the point that I want you to understand that's very significant when specific to Jacob. Remember, Isaac never leaves the land. Abraham is a sojourner. Isaac doesn't leave the land. Jacob is all over the place. Israel, Jacob, represents his descendants, who are also all over the place. Notice he says that I will guard you, Genesis 28, I will guard you wherever you go, and I'll bring you back. Now, the reason I find that interesting is he just described Jacob as being dispersed to the west, to the east, to the north, and to the south. Ultimately, God will bring his people back. Now, in the second dream, in the vision conveyed in Genesis 46, he's told, don't fear going to Egypt, because it is there that I will make you a goy gadol, a great nation. So this particular promise of becoming a goy gadol, a great nation, is exactly what was promised to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. And I will make you a great nation. This plan was conveyed through the patriarchs in stages and phases. Certain ones got certain pieces of it that they understood. Some were told this is not to happen yet. For instance, in Genesis chapter 15, in yet another vision, which is often taken very literally, but one simply has to read it to realize it's a vision. It's in the middle of the day, and he's taken out, and he's told to look up at the stars. Obviously, a vision, people. Genesis chapter 15, read it. He talks about how his descendants, Abraham is told that his descendants will serve another nation. But note, very clearly, what God promises Israel is this. He tells him, I will go with you to Egypt, and he says, I will bring you back. So this is the interesting thing, is that he's going not only to Egypt with him, but he promises that he'll bring him back, and that is something quite extraordinary, I believe, because what it says is that this is an extraordinary promise. It talks about the self-exile of Jehovah. Not only will his people go into Egyptian bondage, but God says, I will be with you. Genesis chapter 28, it's the same reading. Now, the reading tells everyone, those that went down to Egypt. So what we find in this particular Torah reading, it describes the seed of Jacob that goes into the land of Egypt. And it lists those family members and the tally that brings us up to 70, right? You know this story. But this story that we read today, that we just read, tells also of a reunion of both Israel and the son who was separated from him and thought to be dead. The son, Joseph, who was thought to be no more. Now, there's an interesting thing here that some might not notice. If you read the narrative, what you find is this. Joseph was 17 years old when he is sold off ultimately into slavery. You remember the story in Genesis 37. He is at Dothan, and he's 17 years old when we meet with him in the story. The next word that reaches Israel is that his son is dead. The trick, the brothers bring the bloody coat and so forth. It's interesting that Joseph spent 17 years, his first 17 years with his father. For 22 years, he is separated from his father. And then he spends the last 17 years of Joseph's life together, the last 17 years of Jacob's life with Jacob. So you get that. There's 17 years, 34 years Joseph and Jacob spend together. And it's quite significant that that's how it plays out. Now look, we are in a season that's commonly associated with games and gifts and chocolate candy called guilt. The focus for Hanukkah, the focus for the season that we find ourselves in is primarily based on tradition. What I have become interested in over the course of many years is not so much the traditional elements, but what is the real meaning, what is the reason, if you will, for the season. And if we're going to discover the reason for the season, to use that popular phrase, we must go back to the prophets. For it's only when we go to the prophets that we discover the true essence of God's Word. Remember, the prophet Haggai, chapter 2, mentions three times, "From this day forward, I will bless you." And he's referring to the 24th day of the ninth month. And notice, remember this as you think back over what I covered today. The prophet Haggai gives two words from Jehovah to the people. And they're associated with not only blessing to God's people, but a promise that those kingdoms which would raise themselves up against Israel will ultimately be destroyed. The references in Haggai are unmistakable. They make us think of the Exodus from Egypt, where the horse and the rider are cast into the sea and so forth. The imagery is unmistakable. This reading today, which began in Genesis chapter 46, verse 28, was anciently associated with this particular season and with the words of the prophet Zechariah. We covered that. It deals with great victories for God's people and that they've taken place during this season. Indeed, according to Hanukkah, there is a popular phrase that's repeated quite often, and it's this, a great miracle happened. If you're in Israel, you say a great miracle happened here. If you're in the exile, you say a great miracle happened there. But here's what I want to leave you with is this idea that a great miracle happens anytime God's people are in need of a great miracle. What God does and what God promises through His prophets is that He will bring about the great miracle of our time, the greatest of which is a reunion of God's people who have been scattered throughout all nations. They've lost their identity. They don't look alike. They come from different ethnic groups. You wouldn't be able to tell. This was my point. But here's something that's interesting. While we look at the great military victories that have happened, when Israel, in the time of the Maccabees, stood up and they won a battle against their enemies, or if we look at General Allenby and the great military event that ultimately led to the recapturing of Jerusalem, or if we look back even months before this happened with General Allenby, if we look back to the Anzac soldiers who defeated the Turks at Beersheba, we have to be careful that we don't put too much of the credit on the military victory, but that we give the glory to the Creator who acts on behalf of His people. According to the annual cycle of readings for this particular Sabbath of Hanukkah, the prophet Zechariah is also appealed to. And I'll tell you that one of the passages read in this week's synagogues around the world are hearing this prophecy. It comes from Zechariah chapter 4, verse 6. Many of you know this by heart. It says, "Not by might, nor by power, but by my spirit, saith Jehovah." You want to know how God's going to bring about the redemption? It's not through our strength. It's not through our might. It's not through our efforts, our human efforts, which are a breath and a whirlwind. But it's through God's, the moving of God's spirit on behalf of His plan. So there's no doubt to me that I don't imagine that General Allenby said, "I've got to wait a couple of minutes, a couple of days before I go into Jerusalem, because that way I'll fulfill prophecy." When the opportunity came, he walked into Jerusalem and put the flag and, you know, did his thing. It was only later that people looked back and said, "You're not going to believe this. It just so happens that it was on that day that Prophet Haggai said, 'From this day forward, I'll bless you.'" In other words, we're not looking for ways to fulfill prophecy. The Maccabees resolved in their heart to stand firm for the covenant, and God moved on their behalf. It wasn't the other way around. They didn't fight and God said, "Okay, I think I'll help them." They resolved in their heart to live according to the ancient faith, and God moved on their behalf. Now, so there are a couple of things. We mentioned this, that the word of Jehovah is what sustains during that particular famine. And we just read that it's not by might, not by power, but by my spirit. Go with me to Isaiah 59, and this I'll use to close. Isaiah 59, verse 21, says this, "And as for me, this is my covenant with them, says Jehovah. My spirit that is upon thee, and my words which I have put in your mouth, shall not depart out of your mouth, nor out of the mouth of your seed, nor out of the mouth of your seed's seed, says Jehovah, from henceforth and from ever." The idea that I wanted you to get is that God's covenant consists of two things: His word that He puts within the mouth of His people, and His spirit that He places upon them. If we move forward from this day forward, from henceforth and forever, with our focus on the word of Jehovah, I'm going to tell you, this is what heals the famine. This is what sustains during the famine, is the word. And if we pray that God's Spirit would come upon us, ultimately, that's what brings about the restoration of Israel. Remember the story in Ezekiel 37. The bones come together, right, when they hear the word of Jehovah, but they don't come to life until the wind and the spirit comes within them. So you need both. That's what the covenant's about. So think about those things. Today is an interesting day. We've covered quite a bit as far as prophecies associated with this restoration. Thank you very much for joining us. Shabbat Shalom.